Coming up on TechNation, we discover what science might do for food, energy, water, and the environment in the Arequipa Valley of Peru. I'll speak with Purdue University Geosciences Professor Tim Philly. Then on TechNation Health, what the World Health Organization calls out as a burning need in many countries worldwide, health care management. Steve Sammet joins us for a solution for Africa. And we'll hear from TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft. He'll tell us about electroceuticals, electricity as medicine. All this coming up on this week's TechNation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
Once again, we ask, what's the difference between data and information? And the answer, again, is that information is data in context. This came to mind immediately during a recent European panel discussing the right to be forgotten versus the right to know. Or perhaps to better rephrase it, my right for you to forget everything I've ever done versus your right to know about it. Several years back, the European Court of Justice issued a ruling which compelled search engines to remove access to information which is inadequate, irrelevant, or no longer relevant in light of the time that has passed when asked by the individual. So there's the context of the objectionable data. The time that has passed with a sprinkling of inadequacy of information and or current relevance. And of course, whoever the information is related to must request that the access to it goes away. Now the search engines, well, they don't own the data. They only own the links to the data. So the right to be forgotten might better be described as the right to forget the links to any of that data about you. That, of course, is problematic. As a result of the 2014 ruling, Google has created a form and reportedly received some 500,000 requests at this writing, with roughly 43% deemed appropriate for removal. Google's online form, Search Removal Request under Data Protection Law in Europe, starts with the first overriding qualifier, your country of residence. A scan of the 33 European states available on the drop-down menu reminds us that the law doesn't apply to everybody. But even if it did, the bad news just can't be avoided. The links are only part of the problem. It's the data. And data is like air, all the Earth's air. Who can stop the air of Asia from blowing its way to North and South America and then on to Europe and Africa? And no, I don't want to hear from the climatologists who might tell me that I got my air travel paths all wrong. You have the picture. Like air, data just flows. One singular copy, and it can be replicated again and again and again. And there's no stopping it. Just as you can pass a law about the air of your country, and it doesn't protect you from the polluted air of your neighbors. Nobody tells Mother Nature what to do, and I'm beginning to believe that with today's interconnected computers and networking, nobody tells data what to do either. Listening to discussions such as these, I often detect an undertone of wanting to return to the good old days, when long ago and far away meant just that. But the internet is the distance killer, both in time and geography. I can as quickly find a pizza restaurant in San Francisco as in Rome or Buenos Aires, just standing on any single spot on the planet. While we can't escape the capability of billions of smartphones, I think we don't quite remember the way things were. My student ID card from graduate school had my picture, my social security number, and my home address. That's lots more information than you consider putting on one now. But then, in the good old days, it wasn't connected to anything. the power of data replication has forever changed, just as the fluid presence of what's information is in constant flux. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, what can science do for a combination mining and agricultural area, which until recently was simply a Peruvian desert? I speak with Purdue University geosciences professor Tim Filley about the interconnection of food, energy, water, and the environment in the Arequipa Valley of Peru. Then on Tech Nation Health, international educator Steve Samet talks about the development of healthcare management expertise in Africa. And we'll hear from Tech Nation Health chief correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft about electroceuticals, electricity as medicine. Many people know of, or at least have heard of, Lima, Peru. But few are aware of its capital and its second largest city, Arequipa. Tim Filley is a professor of geosciences at Purdue University. I asked him, paint us a picture. Tell us about Arequipa and the Arequipa Valley of Peru.
So Arequipa is both a city and a region. So it is in the southern part of Peru, and it's in the deserty area near Chile. It's an abundant of natural resources, incredible geological, ecological, biological, and landscape diversity. In a little over 100 miles, you can go from sea level to 20,000 feet. You can go from coastal desert to alpine meadows and lakes nestled under massive glaciers. It's astounding. It's got huge ore deposits, untapped resources. Abundant fisheries on the coast, glaciers that provide life-giving water to the desert regions and the mid-altitude regions. It's got astounding natural beauty, really deep cultural indigenous heritage that you can see in the architecture and the art and the music. And that also plays out really neat in terms of the cultural diversity because the food is astounding. I mean, it's just this fusion of all these different cultures, and that's not to be missed.
Now, I know that people have been living there for as long as people have been there, but that there's been the Western influences for a number of hundred years. This goes back.
Oh, it does. Obviously the Spanish were controlling it for quite some time, and the viceroy, I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly, but ran the southern Latin American region from Peru, so it was a main capital. And so when you go into these colonial cities, and Arequipa's the city is actually referred to as the White City, and it's made from the volcanic rock deposits and these beautiful, beautiful colonial architecture there. And you're just transported back hundreds of years. It's amazing.
Now, wherever humans go, wherever they've lived for a long time, there's always a big impact on the land. What's happened over these centuries to Arequipa?
Well, because Arequipa is, and Peru in general, are blessed with many natural resources, the glaciers, copper, the zinc, the gold, the fisheries, right? There's been obviously massive extraction efforts to recover that and use it for growth. And so, for the example, the mining industry has been used for thousands of years, and so all the way back into the Inca. And so there's impacts of that locally when they mined it. But as you became more industrialized and extractive efficiencies became greater and the ability to pull out more increased, you had greater and greater accumulative effects of some of these negative externalities, as you might call them. So right now, mining represents greater than, 60%, I think, of the economy of Peru. And efficient mines, well-run mines, you know, obviously have a great effort in terms of environmental protection, water reuse and such. But unfortunately, there's also a lot of illegal mining that goes on in Peru.
Really?
Oh, my goodness, yes. And so the local impacts are devastating in terms of some of the mercury that comes out, the mineral exports as they're rolling down the streams. And so that is a big problem. It kind of gets to a large part of a problem with Peru in terms of monitoring, measuring, and regulating many of these activities is that there's a large degree of informality in the economy in Peru.
Give us a sense today how many people are spread over what kind of square miles or however you want to spread that out, and then where are the mines in relation to that?
So the nation of Peru has about 30 million people in it, and those are mostly concentrated in the north. In the southern part where Arequipa is, the city itself has only about 1 million, so it's a small region. The population is concentrated in that Arequipa city region. And so there's vast tracts of desert in Arequipa where no one lives or where no one lived until recently. And this is actually an important part of the work that we're doing. So what they've been doing to basically expand out of this valley that Arequipa is in, to expand out agriculture, they're undertaking some of the most massive irrigation projects, you know, the world has seen, pulling water in from the glacial uplands, redistributing river waters up into the highlands, and creating, you know, what they are looking to achieve is some agricultural oases.
And where are the mines all in through these areas? Are they separate?
They are scattered. Yeah, the mines, the mineral reserves are scattered throughout Peru. Many of them are untapped. But if you look at Arequipa, so one of the largest mines is actually right outside of town.
So it's hard to say what's the problem here. Is it the mining? Is it all this water being redistributed? Is it the impact of agriculture, which can be tremendous? Is it the fact there are more people here? Is it the fact that they're taking over what used to be desert? Now they're making it arable land. And that's just the beginning.
The whole issue is that these problems are interrelated. And so you have competition for natural resources among major industries. So developing agriculture, which may only represent, let's say, 6% of the GDP of Peru versus mining, which is the major, actually, resource of Peru. But they compete for the same resource, water. They compete for, in some areas, land. They both bring benefit. They both helped Peru lower poverty rates enormously over the last few decades. You know, in the cities, it might be 20% now. And in the rural areas, it's still quite high, in the upper 50s. But these new types of production, these new ventures that they're doing are generating great good, new infrastructure, new resources for education, but they have negative accumulated impacts. And so what we're doing is to try to look at the conflicts between these developing sectors in the economy, seeing how we can develop tools to actually explore how to share resources and how to talk to the people who are the stakeholders who will be actually making the decisions about how these resources are monitored and measured and shared.
Now, usually when a professor says to me, you know, we're working with these people or we're doing this, we're talking about a professor's individual research, at best a couple of colleagues, some graduate students. But as I understand it, Purdue University as in a much wider basis is working with the people in Arequipa.
Yeah, and actually the whole way that this process developed was actually quite fascinating. There is the university we're working with, which is the National University of St. Augustine. Their president and vice president really are quite visionary, and they were looking to transform their university into a beacon in Latin America for sustainable use of natural resources. And they had developed a way, a mechanism to access some of the tax dollars that had been accumulating from the mining industry, and to use them to actually get into a technical alliance with a university to develop capacity in their programs for soil monitoring, for research, for social sciences in this sustainability area. And so they had made a connection with a not-for-profit organization called CORE Foundation, and CORE Foundation contacted Purdue. And it actually started off sort of peer-to-peer. They talked to a few faculty members one-on-one, and nothing was ever clicking. Everything was too hyper-focused in one particular area. So they then talked to the director of Discovery Park, Tomas Diaz de la Rubia. And Tomas,
what's Discovery Park?
So Discovery Park is a program that doesn't exist in any particular college within Purdue. It is outside of that, and it is a collection of centers and institutes that are geared towards promoting innovation and research and commercialization in areas of nanotechnology, sensor application, cancer research, defense, food security, climate change.
Anything the university does, you'll find in Discovery Park at some level.
Well, yes, but what it does is it's a space that is designed to gather expertise across the university and to address really grand challenge problems, things that really required multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary ideas that really can't be developed within a department or even two departments. And so Discovery Park provides that home. It provides resources. It provides the ability to incubate and catalyze new ideas. And so it was at that point that the idea of, like, let's pull together everything that Purdue has to offer in relation to the social sciences, environmental awareness, holistic watershed management, and soil sustainability and health, tech development in arid environments, pull it together and create an institute-level program with our partner UNSA now to solve these challenges.
And UNSA is the name for the university in Arequipa.
Yes, UNSA is the acronym that we use for Universidad Nacional de St. Augustine.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Tim Filley. He's a professor at Purdue University and head of the Filley Lab in the Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences. He also co-directs the scientific programs at the Arequipa Nexus Institute for Food, Energy, Water, and the Environment at Peru's St. Augustine National University. Now, here we have the Arequipa Nexus Institute, and you're co-directing the scientific programs. What kind of science will you do here in Arequipa?
We have a number of different scientific engagement levels that we're doing. We're first starting off with infrastructure projects, where we are looking across large-scale tracts of land, large watersheds, and taking tools, modeling tools we've developed at Purdue, that actually help people to make decisions about how to better manage that land. We're taking these models, transforming them into an Arequipa-specific model, so co-developing them with modelers in Arequipa to incorporate issues of climate, incorporate issues of resource management, incorporate issues of geography, and making them specific for the stakeholders of that region. Some of the other things we're doing is directly addressing some of the inefficiencies and problems with irrigation in the region. So we have programs that are looking at robotic systems for continuous monitoring and delivery of water, fresh water in these irrigation systems. So taking our tech development programs, working with UNSA's tech development programs, and looking at how we can take these robotic systems into these desert environments to maximize efficiency of water delivery and minimize contamination.
What do the robots do?
A couple of things. One of the systems is going to be designed for looking at monitoring of actually highly contaminated water where you might not actually want to send someone because it might be too dangerous. So these will have sensors on them. They will be automated systems that can go into highly contaminated water. That's one of them. The other system will be actually looking at delivery systems for irrigation. And so you can have timed systems, in-situ monitoring of water quality, water amounts. It will check for leakage. And so to maximize the input of water to minimize loss. Because remember, again, this is a desert region. You don't want to lose water. You want to put just what you need on.
I keep thinking that if suddenly we're going out into a desert region and we're turning it into an agricultural region, what's the impact on that?
Well, the world's got a lot of experience with this. We've done this a lot.
We do it all the time.
We do it in Southern California, right? The city of Los Angeles. There's some very interesting things that have been going on in the Arequipa region. And so we've created a very lush environment. People are benefiting greatly. You're able to produce avocados, grapes, pomegranates, and people are making money. But the problem is sometimes the water source is contaminated. And so you have river water that maybe shouldn't be used for irrigation being used for irrigation in some places. That needs to be monitored. You have water that's being added in a very inefficient way. Flood irrigation is just drenched over the surface of the water. And what happens is massive amounts of water goes through, leaches out salts, but that water doesn't go away. It travels through the ground and it hits a boundary, let's say. Maybe it's 50 feet below ground, 40 feet below ground, and then starts to move out into the valley. And what's pouring out is salt water. And so even though you're doing this wonderful thing in terms of creating agriculture on these uplands, the valleys now are getting this influx of very salty water, which is changing their whole ecosystem. So there are these negative externalities for what we're doing, and that what we're trying to do is to model all of that, to look at it into totality and to talk to the people who are working there so to find out exactly what's going wrong, what's going right, and then how to basically have creative solutions. This also brings up a point of how the social sciences are so integral in our research. We need to talk to the stakeholders. We need to talk to the practitioners. We're sending our scientists, our social scientists out. They're looking at ways of addressing these problems, looking at new methods of bringing people together to form models of how to address conflict, because you have people in the uplands who are creating agriculture in a new area, but potentially contaminated the lowlands. And so those communities need to be brought together to find potential solutions. The fascinating thing about this example is I spent the last 3 weeks in Peru, and we went visiting farms, looking for potential collaborators among the farmers there. And we met a farmer, Mr. Bustamante, and he took us out for about an hour, showed us all his great new vineyards, all his new agricultural tracts he's put in. And we were asking, what are the problems that you have? How can we help you? What can we do for you in this relationship? And he smiled and he said, just kind of put me off a little bit. We piled into his car and we drove to the edge of an escarpment, a large valley. And he pointed out to the horizon. And as far as you could see, about 40 feet down on the cliff was all new green, lush things and plants and riverlets of water flowing out. And he said, we're wasting water and it's hurting the valley. He said, and look what I'm doing. And he showed us tens of hectares of land where he put in drip irrigation, small tubes where the water is delivered precisely by the roots. He says, I'm the first one to put that in this region. I want other people to do that.
Now, that's a farmer. What about the miners, both legal and illegal? What's happening there? They're being told to shut down? What can you do?
There is a lot of local opposition to new mines, and people have actually shut down the development of new mining production. There's a lot of opposition, particularly when mines start to talk about how they're going to use water resources in a very dry region. And so UNSA itself is actually setting up a number of different institutes in relationship to different universities. Some of them will specialize in actually sustainable mining practices, and we'll be partnering with them down the line. But right now, the Nexus Institute that we are running is going to be focusing on more watershed development, monitoring of contamination, monitoring of soil health and clean water, and providing solutions in the form of these holistic models and how to work in the context of where they are right now.
Meanwhile, back in Indiana, you're the interim director for the Center for the Environment at Discovery Park.
Correct.
But in the Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences, there is the Philly Lab. And I have to say, I thought, oh, this is really great. I'll be able to figure out what you really do, when you're left alone to your own devices. Unfortunately, it's called Terrestrial Stable Isotope Biogeochemistry.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's... We could work with you on this. I think we could work. I don't even want you to parse it. I want you to tell me what it means.
All right.
Because there's a whole lot of people you have there working as we speak.
I am a professor of geochemistry and agronomy. And so that means I work in the terrestrial environment. I work on land. My group blends principles and tools from those two systems, geochemistry and agronomy.
And I think a lot of people don't know what geochemistry and agronomy is.
Oh, okay. Well, let me step back a little further. So what I try to do is I try to look at what controls the health of soil. I look at what controls the destruction of soil. And I look at all the influences from different types of land use, let's say agriculture or forestry, changes in climate, erosion, changes in contaminants, and how those control how soil evolves, how soil devolves, and how you can maintain it in a healthy way.
I think what I'm hearing is soil is actually created and evolves and erodes and comes back together.
Soil is very dynamic. And soil is really not a renewable resource. We have to be very careful with soil. Soil takes a long time to evolve in most environments. And so that's kind of the research that we focus on. We look at what makes up the soil, the minerals, the organic matter, the microbes in it, and how they respond to things that promote good soil production or how they respond to stresses that actually break apart that soil and cause sometimes irreparable damage to it. And so soil is something that's quite precious, and we have to protect it. Because in some places, soils take thousands and thousands of years to develop. And in a matter of decades, you can destroy all of that work over time, and it won't come back in our lifetime or your grandkids' lifetimes.
Hence the Dust Bowl.
Hence the Dust Bowl.
In the 30s in Oklahoma.
And it can take generations to rebuild soil, but it won't come back to what it was. It's still useful. It's still usable. It still gives you your maize or your soy, but it's not the same as what it was. And it requires more energy, more emphasis to get from it what we need than when we started with it.
Meanwhile, back in Peru, back in Arequipa, we have a whole new land out here that in the past just sat there forever, for millennia. It was desert.
What we're trying to do is, again, look at the system in its totality. How much do we have to put in to keep getting out what we need? What are the negative aspects of what we're doing? Sometimes we don't know yet. We need to figure that out in terms of contaminants, in terms of salination of groundwater, and then looking to see how we can sustain it. Because in reality, what they're doing is pushing up and even exceeding the limits of what that geology, that climate, that environment can provide. You're putting in massive amounts of energy of moving that water and dumping it in, the fertilizer. All of that is needed to get that agriculture out, but is it sustainable? That's the question.
I've been speaking with Purdue University Professor Tim Filley, co-director of the scientific programs at the Arequipa Nexus Institute for Food, Energy, Water, and the Environment. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of TechNation and TechNation Health are available at NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on TechNation Health, one solution to a global problem cited by the World Health Organization, healthcare management. And we'll hear from TechNation Health chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft, about electroceuticals, electricity as medicine. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Purdue University Professor Tim Filley about the work of the scientific programs at the Nexus Institute for Food, Energy, Water, and the Environment in Arequipa, Peru. How well do we know the answer to sustainability in that framework ever? Are we really hip to the beat on this? Like, you show us an area and we can tell you what is sustainable?
Well, so you can think about this. So 70% of the world's high-altitude equatorial glaciers are in Peru. Right? They have lost in some...
What? Yeah. High altitude.
So high altitude around the equator, right? So
yeah.
So high altitude meaning that you're talking 3,000 meters above sea level and above, right? And they are around the equator. Most of those are locked in Peru. And so as the water comes out over the Atlantic Ocean, it reaches these high mountains and dumps all its water out and forms these glaciers. And all the air that comes out towards the Pacific has no water in it. That's why there's a desert on that side. Now, those glaciers have lost 30%+ of their mass in the last few decades. So Peru is looking at a water crisis by mid-century. The farmers know that. Mr. Bustamante, one of the first things he told me is he's worried about the future of his water. He's thinking about putting in deep wells so he can get water from the ground because he knows eventually those glaciers will be gone. And then the farming is gone.
Seems to me they're pretty clear that climate disruption is happening.
Oh, it's very clear. They know that. They know they're working against planetary limits right now.
Because of their interesting situation, it's not fogged by, well, I'm in a city or I can go to the market and I can turn on the tap and the water is here. They can actually see these things change and
yeah.
feel them.
You can see the changes in water movement down the rivers, right? Those fluxes are changing. They're diminishing in some areas. In some areas, they're actually increasing because so much melt is happening now. It's a boom for agriculture. But they also know that that will go away.
That's a short-term...
It's a boom, then bust.
Boom, and there will be a bust. So part of that is what the Nexus Institute is studying as well.
It is. It's to look at the system right now and to see, well, you cannot waste, right? So right now, the types of irrigation that is most dominant there is flood irrigation, just drenching the land. There are other technologies that you need to be thinking about to maximize conservation of that water. But they're going to have to do this in a big way. They're going to have to re-engineer all the sectors of their economies, the nutrient sector, waste from livestock. They're going to have to re-engineer the biomass sector, waste from agriculture. They're going to have to couple all the streams out of their economies so there is no waste. Make it restorative. Add that biomass back into land to rebuild soil, or actually in this case, build soil because it wasn't actually a productive soil before. Take the nutrient waste from the animals, bring that back into the soil to create those soil structures, and make sure you're not wasting water. They need to make their economies regenerative, restorative for their land.
Something that is part of this, but we frequently forget about, is food and what we now call food security. How does this play a role?
Food security encompasses many things. It encompasses distribution systems. It encompasses food safety. Is your food contaminated? It encompasses food nutrition. Poverty is a big part of it. Insecurity in terms of whether you can afford to buy food. Coupled to global markets, are there pressures on your local economy to produce things that you don't eat but you ship off to another country? So food security wraps all those things in there. And actually, this is one of the main emphasis of the Nexus. So our food security center within Discovery Park, led by Gabisa Ajeta, who is a World Food Prize winner, is heading one of the projects to actually develop an international food security center at UNSA to address these issues.
Well, Tim, this is terrific. I hope either you bring that wonderful farmer back or you take me there. I want to drive around in the car with him.
Well, he will sit you down and he will pull out a very large bottle of something called Pisco, which is a brandy he makes from his grape, and you will love it.
I will. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you come back and see us again.
Thank you.
My guest today is Purdue University Professor Tim Filley, head of the Filley Lab in the Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences, and co-director of the scientific programs at the Arequipa Nexus Institute for Food, Energy, Water, and the Environment, a joint alliance of Purdue University and Peru's National University of San Agustin. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Welcome to Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies and breakthrough science. When countries are in need of medical assistance, we usually think of sending supplies and healthcare workers. But according to the World Health Organization, more is needed. We'll talk about what that need is, and then we'll hear from Tech Nation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft. He'll talk about electricity as medicine. Steve Samet is an international educator in healthcare and life science management. The World Health Organization is absolutely adamant. We need more healthcare workers. We need more doctors. We need more nurses. We need more physicians, assistants, you name it.
Exactly, right down the line.
But lately, they've been saying, we need more than that. What is that?
What they've begun to recognize, and it's astonishing that it's taken this long, is that you cannot really have viable healthcare systems or viable hospitals or viable clinics or whatever health services unless you have professionally trained managers. And historically, the default has been that physicians, often at the peak of their career, who tend to be the technically most competent, get drafted into managerial roles. And although they may have the interpersonal skills or not, they certainly don't have the technical skills or preparation in management. And as a result, things don't work as well as they should. And what are the consequences of things not working well? Well, probably many of your listeners have heard of the concept of the brain drain, whereby physicians or nurses who are trained in one country at the expense of that country find greener pastures, not necessarily just for better compensation, but for a better environment in which to practice nursing or medicine. And in my view, and I think many now agree, that that is a failure of management. When people cannot find professional satisfaction, take care of patients the way they were trained to, they're going to look elsewhere. So the solution, develop academic programs and executive programs in order to professionalize management. And that's what I've been working on.
Well, one of the areas we've been working on is to do this in Africa, throughout Africa, first instance in Nairobi. Tell us about what you did there.
Yeah, that was quite interesting. September of 2011, I happened to be in Nairobi on some other business. And while there, I was introduced to the founding dean of the business school of Strathmore University, which is a school that was an institution that was founded right around the time of Kenyan independence in the early 1960s, and which formed a business school only 11 years ago now. And the founding dean, Dr. George Jenga, and I, we hit it off and had a wide-ranging conversation. And I happened to mention to him that I was working in India with the Indian School of Business and the Wharton School in developing a healthcare management MBA. He became quite animated and said he'd been wanting to start a similar program in Kenya for years but didn't know how to get started, and asked if I would help him. And I'm not good at saying no, especially for things like that. And I said, yeah, I'll work on it with you. And he said, you know, this could be the first healthcare management MBA in Kenya. I said, oh, that makes it all the more interesting. So that evening when I was back in my hotel room, I started Googling programs in Africa, and I found that he was correct. It would be the first in Kenya, but it would actually also be the first on the African continent, including Egypt, including South Africa. There just simply was no real provision for a degree in healthcare management on a continent where a billion people reside. So that struck me as quite astonishing and drove home the notion that something really needed to be done. So I undertook for the remainder of the year a on-the-ground detailed needs assessment during which I interviewed hospital administrators, nurses, physicians, health ministers, basically anybody who would talk to me who had who was a stakeholder in healthcare.
And this is in Nairobi.
This is in Nairobi.
To find out what the state of the system is.
That's right. And what I found was that Kenya as a country is very serious about its health system, but there are still gaps. And they were about to enter what their constitution of 2010 mandated, which was devolution of their healthcare system, which is a different way of saying decentralization. So whereas the national government controlled health spending and health services throughout the country, now they pushed that responsibility off to the counties being the equivalent of states in Kenya, which meant that the need for management was about to explode because all of these counties now were going to have effectively autonomous health systems.
They had their own medical facilities.
That's right, their own medical facilities. And there had been, it's not the fault of Kenya or any other African country, but they hadn't built the human resource base to do that. I spent the remainder of 2011 developing the first curriculum for the program and sent that off to Dr. Njenga. Actually, it happened to be Christmas Day 2011. I remember that because I was teaching in Israel, so I thought it would be a nice Christmas present for him. And we then spent 2012 doing two things, vetting the curriculum back with the stakeholders. We did focus groups. We also had to go through the approval process of Strathmore University, which is quite rigorous. Strathmore has extraordinarily high standards as an academic institution. And the feedback we were getting was interesting because what I had designed was a program that was built on the traditional core of 12 MBA courses. And then I allowed for half a dozen elective and major courses in health management. And we were getting very consistent feedback that that really did not serve the needs. And what everyone wanted to see was a curriculum that included healthcare content from day one, even in the financial and managerial accounting course, in the marketing course, in the human resources course. So I had to go back and essentially redesign the syllabus and write course descriptions for an 18-course program. And you're a professor, so you know that typically a one—
You didn't do that over the weekend.
No, it was not over the weekend. And unlike the U.S., where in most universities 36 classroom hours constituted a course, the requirement in Kenya is 45 hours. So that's a lot of content to fill. We had to do that for 18 courses, and the country requires of all master's degree programs a dissertation, which is serious original research, and that has to be completed before a degree can be conferred. And as of 2018, those dissertations will have to be published in order to certify graduation. So they've set a standard that I think relatively few American students could meet.
Unwilling.
Yeah, I think unwilling is the word. But suffice it to say that the standard and the expectations are very high. We submitted the package for approval to the Kenyan Commission on Higher Education in January of 2013. So it took a year to get ready. And we were fully prepared for the one-year review process that it typically takes. And 10 weeks later, we actually got the green light from the education ministry to go ahead. And I believe what happened was they consulted with the health ministry, which had a sense of ownership, rightfully.
They've already been here, they said.
rightfully. And we had input into this whole program, and we really, really need it, so expedite. So we then set about doing two things. Number one, completing recruitment of the faculty, because I had to bring in over a dozen friends of mine from the U.S. and the U.K. to assist with the teaching, because although there's a very strong base of faculty qualified to teach typical or general MBA, that was not true in healthcare. So I enlisted some friends who effectively came pro bono to do the teaching and to work with local faculty to help develop them in their competence and their skills to teach healthcare management. So we're now down to four international faculty, and the program is effectively taught by local faculty that were under the tutelage for a while of our international faculty. We've had a total of five cohorts in the program. The first two have graduated with 19 and 34 students, respectively.
So basically 50-plus.
50-plus,
yeah. In the field now.
That's right. And each class we target generally about 35 students. And it's working. And we're surveying with the help of a group that's been funded by USAID. We're trying to survey impact to see what we can do to make the next iteration better. And now there are some international finance organizations and foundations looking at what we're doing and are talking to me about funding what I'm calling the African Institute for Healthcare Management, which is basically designed to develop faculty research and teaching materials in the field so that we can accelerate the growth and the expansion of these programs into other African countries.
So which African countries next? Which cities?
I'm looking, and I've had discussions with the Lagos Business School in Nigeria, and the reason is they actually have a relationship with Strathmore, so it's one of the paths of least resistance. Ethiopia's health system is very strong, and they're amenable to it. Ghana is a very rapidly developing country, as is Zambia, and, of course, South Africa. We have already alliance with two institutions in South Africa, University of Cape Town and University of Witwatersrand.
So watch out. Steve's coming.
I'm coming.
this huge career you've had, which we haven't mentioned, and we don't even need to.
I don't think it's necessary.
You don't even, you know, it's like, what's next? We'll do it.
it's all about impact. And, you know, not to editorialize too much on your program. And while I think international development agencies, you know, since the Second World War, have done an incredible job, and poverty throughout the world has been incredibly alleviated, I think there's room for some more new strategies. And the more we can reduce dependence on aid systems and do human resource capacity building, the better off we're all going to be, and the more accelerated the growth and health of these populations is going to be developed. And this was something I started with the boot camp that you're part of, that we started here at BIO, the BIO Entrepreneurship Boot Camp. And in addition to the 13 that we've done here at BIO, I've actually done 41 of them in 14 countries, including the U.S. over the—
You're getting pretty good at this.
Yeah. They don't deport me from the countries when I do it, so I guess that's a good sign.
Good sign.
Yeah.
Good
sign. But at this point now, through all the boot camps that I've done, we've had, well, just with BIO, we've now had about 1,200 people go through those programs. We're up around internationally over 3,000 people. That's a lot of entrepreneurs, even though there's tens of thousands of companies. professionally training entrepreneurs to avoid making mistakes, I think adds a level of efficiency to the industry that we really need. So,
well, Steve, thanks so much, and good luck to you. I know you'll come back and see us, right?
Of course I will. It was always a pleasure to be with you.
Steve Samet is an international educator in healthcare and life science management. More information about the MBA in healthcare management at Strathmore University in Nairobi, Kenya, can be found at sbs.strathmore.edu. Detailed information on the current status of global health and global healthcare needs is available from the World Health Organization at who.org. When interventions in our health are called for, we think of many things, from physical therapy all the way to surgery. But today, TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft gives us a new one, which is actually a very old one. It's electricity as medicine.
Yeah, it's an interesting, not even so new of a field where we're thinking about delivering electricity as medicine. It can be called bioelectronic medicine, electroceuticals, there's a few buzzwords around it. But if you think back in terms of our medical history, we've been doing forms of electricity as medicine since the late 1950s. The pacemaker for the heart is a classic form. In the 1980s, we got the cochlear implants for folks who are blind. That's a sort of a brain-computer interface that listens to sound and transmits that to electrical impulses. We have spinal cord stimulators that we use to manage pain, deep brain stimulators for folks who often have tremors, all the way to now newer forms of neurostimulators for like the vagus nerve to maybe impact everything from our diet to our sort of ability to urinate, sacral nerve stimulators. So the field isn't so new, but we're now seeing this convergence of the technology and the data and the hardware come together to be able to think about using electricity not just centrally with implanted devices, but forms that can work peripherally as well. So it's an exciting era of this form of new electricity as medicine.
And let me just quickly ask you, in the terms of the pacemaker, not everybody knows exactly what that does.
Well, classically, you might have a patient with heart disease where the top part of the heart, their atrium, isn't coordinated with the lower part. So the lub-dub isn't always happening in the normal two-step. And so patients, maybe they've had a heart attack or some other damage to the electrical components of their heart, will need a pacemaker to keep their heart not too slow or not too fast. So there are sort of the simple versions, which will just pace you, you know, and keep you at a certain heart rate. Now, the newer ones will adjust based on your activity. Some of them even have integrated defibrillators. So if someone's heart starts to quiver and would normally be almost a full-on heart attack, they can re-jump start their heart just like you see when folks are on TV.
Big charge of electricity.
Yeah, embedded there. It's a bit of a jolt. People know when that happens. So those are forms of electricity that have been used in the clinical realm for about 50 years. It goes all the way back even to the ancient Greeks who used to use those electric eels on the head to treat epilepsy and headaches. And the Greek word for electric fish is narca, which means relief from pain, so like narcotics. So there's some ancient history to this as well. But given that we have a lot of, you know, an aging population, issues with neurologic diseases like Parkinson's and tremor, there's a lot of interest now in using electricity in new ways. Companies like a spin-out from Stanford called Kala Health, led by Kate Rosenbluth, sort of describes this whole evolution as moving from sort of the deep brain stimulation, the big implants, to ways to look at our peripheral nerves. So if someone has a tremor with Parkinson's, we can now treat that with some deep brain stimulation. That's a neurosurgery a bit more involved. But what if you could sort of read the peripheral nerves and then apply some low energy there? That might have some interesting approaches to treating tremor.
We always think of our nerves and our brains as having all this sort of electricity running around in them. Is that true?
Well, we're sort of electrical beams. The Internet of Things is the Internet of the body. There are even the idea that, you know, our peripheral organs and internal organs, our blood supply, all is affected by the nerves, which run through sort of these electrical impulses. And as we can get technology exponentially smaller and cheaper and more integrated, we've been seeing companies like Google's Health Verily work with pharma companies like GlaxoSmithKline. They have a new company called Galvani. And what they're working to do is make these tiny little bioelectronic devices that can even go around the sheaths of your nerves to sort of potentially regulate organs, like turning on and off the volume, up and down the volume. So we are electrical beings, and we know that our nerve, you know, our autonomic nerve system, our sympathetic, turning things up and down is how we regulate our body. And often we use drugs to try and impact, whether it's an opiate or other molecules. There's, I think, the interesting potential to blend these two together in this era of electricity as medicine.
It really adds a whole new spectrum in the sense that this isn't a one-off or a two-off, if you will, of things. It's like, okay, great, we have physical therapy, we have drugs, we have surgery, and that was kind of it.
Sure, and because there's so many unmet needs here, and we don't want to be stuck on sort of drugs per se, we can think of new ways to apply these in pretty minimally invasive ways. Let's say headaches. Instead of taking a pain medicine, there's now trigeminal nerve stimulators that you can wear on your forehead that apply energy to the trigeminal nerves, which seem to play a role in some forms of headaches. We have intranasal tear stimulators, little electrical pharmaceuticals to stimulate tears for folks who often have dry eyes. We've seen the idea of neuroperipheral therapy, again, for things like tremor. Or you can even go off the shelf and buy wearables for pain. There's a company that makes a device called Quell, which you can wrap around your knee if you have knee pain and seems to reduce and impact the pain pathway. So really interesting elements here going beyond the drug or the pure device.
And, of course, devices of any sort are much cheaper to develop, easier to get past the FDA, many months, if not years, to get to the consumer. So any explosion in innovation that works is liable to get to us quicker.
Particularly if it's something implanted in the body instead of the class 1, class 2, class 3 FDA devices, the more wearable and less invasive it is, the more less complicated the regulatory path is. But we still need to show that these things work. There's still placebo effects that might be there. You may be wearing the little electrical device on your arm and think it's helping your pain, but it may be in your head. And again, a lot of pain is in your head. We can talk more about the challenge of the opiate addiction era, but we're learning now to tune our brains, whether it's with mindfulness or virtual reality, other ways to sort of rewire the pain pathways per se. Another component is not just the devices, but collecting the big data from these. So we're learning how to measure our neuroelectrical activity. There's the field of optogenetics. There's the fMRI world. So if we start to understand what's happening inside our sort of central nervous system and see how that's connected to our peripheral nervous system, we can start to hopefully use the two to program each other and treat a variety of conditions.
Well, Daniel, this is terrific. I hope we'll talk about this again.
It's electric.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is chief correspondent of TechNation Health and the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BiotechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.